He had reacted poorly in the past, you see, when young ladies came to visit, and I thought surprising him with it might be the way to go. But I was wrong. He assumed it was another case of ambitious young ladies after his wealth or his title, and he couldn't bear another visit like that. There have been so many, you know. He left that evening without a word to me. She looked closely at me, as if trying to convince me of something by the force of her gaze. But then he met you at the inn, and he came back. Her smile warmed her eyes. He came back, my dear, that very night, late in the night. Now I must confess to a little meddling on my part. When he returned and told me what had happened to you and how he had met you at the inn, I had a suspicion. So I wrote to Rachel and told her to keep the girls an extra week in London, using the masquerade ball as an excuse. Your first evening here, when Philip came into the drawing room and saw you. She breathed deeply, shaking her head a little, as if in wonder. He lit up, Marianne, just like he used to do. She rested her hand on mine and squeezed it. I had my Philip back. I watched in surprise as her eyes filled with tears. But when she smiled, I realized they were tears born of joy. Forgive me if I have been too personal, she said, gracefully wiping a tear from her cheek. But after losing my dear husband and my son Charles, it felt like more than I could bear to lose Philip, too. Dismay filled me. She was giving me too much credit for whatever change she had seen recently in Philip. I was certain I was not responsible, for it was in direct opposition to what I had heard from Philip with my own ears. He didn't want me here. Something else must have made him happy. It certainly wasn't me. I wanted to tell her how mistaken she was, but I couldn't. Thank you for sharing that with me, I said, attempting to smile. I feel like I understand your family a little better now. She looked at me in her keen way. I hoped it would help you understand Philip a little better. Yes, that too, I said to placate her. And then I quickly excused myself. Her hope was too painful to witness. If she thought that my relationship with Philip had sparked the change in him that had made her so happy, then she would be very disappointed when I left Edenbrook next week. Halfway to the house, my steps faltered, then stopped. A gentleman was walking toward me across the lawn, coming from the direction of the woods. Mr. Kellett. I thought of turning and running in the other direction, but he called out to me.
You're not thinking of running away from me, are you, cousin?
Why would he not stop calling me that? I stood my ground and frowned, refusing to let him think I was afraid of him. No, I am not. I am only going to take a turn around the lawn. You are welcome, of course, to join me. He smiled as if that had been his plan all along, and he had just manipulated me into doing what he wanted, which was probably true. He seemed to delight in vexing me. We began to walk, me quickly, and he with a strolling gait that made me want to yank his walking cane out of his hand and break it over his head. He would try to prolong my suffering.
How is the old bird?
He asked, referring, I gathered, to my grandmother. I gave him a haughty look. Still in good health, I believe. He sighed and looked up at the sky.
Will she never die?
I shot him an angry look, ready to berate him, but he laughed and said,
You are so easily taken in, cousin. You should do something about that.
I hated thinking that he had the upper hand, and I was through with politeness. Stop calling me cousin. Why are you here?
Visiting my dear cousin, of course.
I stopped and turned to him. No, I mean, why are you here in Kent? Did you follow me? He laughed.
You flatter yourself.
He stopped and leaned on his walking cane.
But I did receive some interesting news. Evidently, your grandmother has decided my scandalous behavior has shamed her long enough, and she has cut me out of her will.
Oh? His eyes narrowed.
And I thought to myself, who would she name her heir if not me? Not that old maid Amelia.
He pointed his walking cane at me.
You.
I decided to meet his challenge head on. You are right, but the inheritance is conditional. She can still cut me off without a penny, just as she did to you.
Conditional on what?
That is none of your concern, cousin. He laughed lightly and raised an eyebrow.
Touché.
He studied me for a moment with narrowed eyes, as if debating a course of action. I watched with a sense of misgiving as a slow smile spread across his face.
Well, this has been very enlightening, but now I have somewhere else to be.
He bowed casually and turned away to saunter toward the road. Several leaves clung to the back of his coat, and one was even sticking out of the top of his boot. Good riddance, I thought. But I couldn't help wondering why he would come all the way here to ask those few questions. And what had he been doing in the woods? A movement out of the corner of my eye caught my attention. It was Cecily, walking from the direction of the woods. She was brushing off her skirt, and, as I watched, she pulled a leaf out of her hair. I stared at her, feeling sick. This was the kind of conduct she had learned in London? This was considered acceptable behavior for an elegant young lady? I turned away, disgusted at the sight of her disheveled hair and happy smile. When I reached my room, I wrote two letters. The first was quick and to the point. Dear Grandmother, I have had the misfortune of seeing Mr. Kellett in the area. I have also lost James, the coachman you hired. Also, I know that you arranged for this visit and made everyone lie to me about being invited here. If you didn't want me, you should have just told me so instead of letting me impose on someone else. And I am not impressed with elegant young ladies at all. I think I would prefer to milk cows for the rest of my days. Sincerely, Marianne. I meant exactly what I wrote. I had no desire to become like Cecily. And if that was what was required to earn a fortune, then I would simply not earn that fortune. I was not destitute, after all. My father was well enough off, and I would have an inheritance from him. But I would not waste any more of my time trying to become someone I was not. After I finished my letter to Grandmother, I saw Mr. Whittles's book of poems in the drawer and thought of another letter I had been meaning to write for some time. The second letter took more thought, but when I finally finished with it, I was pleased with the result. There was so much waste in hoping for something that could never be yours, I decided. It was better to seize happiness where it was available. I addressed the letter to Mr. Whittles. Chapter 22. The next morning, Mr. Beaufort called on me again. As soon as he entered the drawing room, he addressed Lady Caroline. Is there some place I might speak with Miss Daventry in private? Oh, no. Lady Caroline said something about needing to speak with the housekeeper and shut the door behind her as she left. I was not ready for this conversation. It had happened too quickly, and I had given no thought as to how I might respond. I gestured toward the settee. Would you like to sit down? Only if it pleases you, he said with a smile. I sat on the settee and folded my hands in my lap, wondering what to say to him. Evidently, he did not need my contribution, though. He sat next to me and said, Miss Daventry, I have not been able to stop thinking of you since the moment I laid eyes on you. You have captured my heart, and I cannot restrain myself from declaring that I love you. He grasped my hand and knelt before me. I have little in the ways of the world to offer you, but what I can offer you is my undying affection, my esteem, and my relentless adoration of you.
Will you do me the honor of accepting my hand in marriage? I wondered how I had ever thought him handsome. His eyes seemed like shallow pools, nothing like the depth I always saw in Philip's eyes. Of course, I was not choosing between Mr. Beaufort and Philip, because Philip had not offered for me. But I was choosing for myself, and even if nobody else wanted me, I did not want to spend the rest of my life looking into those dull, shallow eyes. "I am sorry," I said. "I cannot accept you." Mr. Beaufort's smile dropped, and his eyes flashed with something like anger. I leaned away from him, surprised by the sudden turn in his emotion. But he abruptly returned to smiling and said, "Perhaps you need time to consider my offer." He took my hand and pressed his lips to it. "I will be happy to call on you again." He left before I could tell him not to bother. I was sure I would not be changing my mind. I would rather grow into an old spinster than marry a man I did not love, now that I knew what it meant to love. I walked across the room and stood in front of my mother's painting. Had Lady Caroline been right about my mother? Had she felt like Lady Caroline had everything my mother wanted? If so, I understood perfectly why the friendship had ended. I think I would hate Cecily forever if she had everything I wanted, Edenbrook and Meg and Philip, especially Philip. I touched the frame and leaned toward the painting, wishing fiercely for my own mother. "My dear, are you unwell?" I lifted my head. It was Mrs. Clumpet with her perpetual smile. Even now, with her forehead creased with worry, her mouth still turned up. "No, I am well," I said, "only a little homesick." She nodded. "I can well understand that feeling. Mr. Clumpet and I have missed our own home. The birds around here are just not the same, and the library is so disorganized." I smiled. "You're right. In fact, now that I think of it, I believe it's time for us to go home. Oh, wait, I forgot." She glanced at me quickly, then turned away. "We will have to stay a little while longer," she sighed. "Unless, tell me, do you think you might be leaving any time soon?" I thought of my letter to my father. "Perhaps," I said. "I hope so, but it's hard to know." She nodded, and for once she didn't look like she was smiling. Was her decision somehow tied up in my plans? Why would that be so? Was this one more person who didn't want me here? "Let me know when you have your plans settled," she said. "I do miss our birds." It was such a little thing to say, "I do miss our birds," but it touched me deeply. It reminded me of everything I missed about my own home and the happiness I had once felt there. Time in Philip's absence did terrible things. Clocks slowed, the sun stood still in the sky, even the nights stretched longer than normal. I felt as if entire months had passed since the ball, though it had only been 4 days. I went about my normal activities. I ate food, and I slept, and I spent my days in the company of the other women. But through it all, I felt as if an important part of me was absent. Perhaps it was my heart. Cecily and I had hardly spoken since I had stormed out of her room the day after the ball. She and Louisa were thick as thieves. They were always going off on walks together and whispering to each other. I did not attempt to join them. Instead, I focused on my new project. Rather than trying to fulfill my grandmother's assignment, I spent my free time painting scenes of Edenbrook. 5 days after Philip left, I had half a dozen paintings of some of my favorite views of the estate. I wanted to record as much as I could of this place, which, for a time, had been the closest thing to paradise I could have imagined on earth. I mourned the thought of leaving this place forever. When Cecily married Philip, I would not come back here, I knew it. My mother never came back,
and now I understood why. I was sketching the view from my bedroom window when Cecily came into my room.
"Only 3 more days until the ball," she said.
I nodded, keeping my gaze on the bridge as I worked on making the angles of the arch look just right. If I looked at just the angles and stones, I could train myself to not think of Philip riding toward the bridge with a whistle on his lips. It was hard work, but I was subduing my heart a little more every day.
"I don't know what I will do if Sir Philip doesn't come back in time for the ball," she said, flopping down on my bed. Her golden hair fanned around her face as she pouted at the ceiling. "I have spent hours planning exactly how I'm going to make him declare his feelings for me. And if he isn't here, I will be so disappointed I will die. You don't know what it's like to have all of your hopes for your future happiness pinned on one man. The suspense is excruciating."
I rolled my eyes. "I'm sure you will not die of disappointment, Cecily. And if Sir Philip is going to declare himself, he will probably find an opportunity to do so without your scheming." I thought I had my heart firmly under control, but the words I spoke caused sharp stabs of pain. The thought of Philip declaring himself to Cecily was too much for me to contemplate. "Perhaps Mr. Kellett will come and keep you entertained if Sir Philip isn't here in time," I said. I couldn't keep the touch of malice out of my voice, but Cecily didn't appear to notice.
"I hope so," she said, rolling over onto her stomach. "I made sure he was on the guest list. See, you will have plenty of pleasure to look forward to."
She smiled with a faraway look in her eyes, as if remembering something enjoyable.
"I wonder who is the better kisser, Sir Philip or Mr. Kellett?"
She looked at me.
"Who would you rather kiss?"
"Neither," I lied.
"I don't know either. But I'll be sure to let you know when I find out."
Resentment surged within me. "If you do find out, please don't tell me. There are some things I would rather not hear."
"By the way," she said, "whatever happened with Mr. Beaufort?"
I was surprised to realize I hadn't told her. But then, I had hardly talked to Cecily at all since Philip left. "He offered for me, and I rejected him. That is all."
"Good. I didn't want to tell you at the time, but I think there's something not quite right about him."
I thought of his shallow eyes and had to agree with her assessment. Before she left, she looked over my shoulder at my drawing.
"You have a real gift for art. You're much better at it than I will ever be."
"Thank you." What a nice thing to say. I looked at my drawing, then up into my sister's face. I had let my feelings for Philip come between us, and I was sorry for it. I set down my pencil and turned to her.
"Cecily, can I ask you something?"
"Yes, of course."
I took a deep breath, gathering my courage, and asked, "Did you want me to come to Edenbrook, or was it Lady Caroline's idea?" She tilted her head.
"What made you ask that?"
I held her gaze. "Just tell me, please." Cecily tucked a strand of my hair back into its twist.
"It may have been Lady Caroline's idea, but of course I wanted you. You're my sister."
She said it so matter-of-factly that I believed her. My heart lifted and I smiled. It felt so strange to smile, and such a relief at the same time, that I had to stop and think about the last time I had smiled. I couldn't remember a single instance of happiness since Philip had left.
"I think we need to spend more time together," Cecily said. "I've missed you."
"I've missed you too."
I felt a real fondness for her in that moment, and after she left, I continued to smile.
The next afternoon, I was sketching the view from the library window when Rachel found me. I almost had the orchard complete. When I painted it, I would make the sky look overcast, as it looked the day Philip and I spent in here.
"Oh, there you are," she said. "I've been looking for you."
I looked up from my drawing. She came toward me with a smile.
"I have just received a letter from William."
I stared at her.
Did men really write home to their wives while they were off carousing? I knew you would want to hear it, she continued, as she closed the door and came to sit next to me, as it mentions Philip. Dread made my heart pound hard. I shook my head. No, I don't. I can't imagine there is anything in there I am interested in hearing. Come now, you can be honest with me. I've seen how you've been moping around the house. And if it's not Philip you're pining for, it's William, and that would not suit me well at all. I frowned at my drawing. I am not pining for anyone. Nonsense, of course you are. She smiled brightly at me, then looked at her letter. Let's see, it sounds like they are really enjoying themselves. Oh, here is the part I wanted to read to you. Philip has fallen in love with a real beauty, with nice legs and beautiful lines. He thinks the price is too dear, but I would not be surprised if he brings her home in the end. I felt as if I were being strangled. I had no wish to hear about Philip's conquests, I choked out. Rachel looked up. No, dear, you know they aren't participating this year. I could not look her in the face. They weren't participating? What did that mean? I didn't know that much about these things. They're not? She looked at me curiously. No, because Philip gave that horse to you to ride instead. I thought you knew. That horse? Some part of my mind was not working properly, obviously, because I could not fathom what a horse had to do with any of this. Do you mean Meg? She waved dismissively. Whatever the name is. I was working hard to assemble this puzzle, but without success. What does Meg have to do with whether or not they participate? I blushed, saying the word. She stared at me as if I were daft, then set the letter down on her lap and spoke slowly and carefully. Well, my dear, they need a horse in order to participate in the races. And they didn't take a horse this year because Philip gave you a racehorse to ride and then didn't want to take her away from you. I gaped at her. Races? Horse races? Yes, they're at Newmarket. I thought you knew that. But you told me that your father would not have approved of what they were doing. No, it's true. He never did approve of racing, she sighed. But there are a lot worse ways for a man to spend his free time, so I don't stop William from going. She smoothed her hand over the letter in an affectionate gesture. It has been a dream of his all along to breed racehorses, but of course it's not financially possible for us. To be honest, I have suspected that Philip might be doing all of this more for William's sake than for his own interest. She smiled a little wistfully. He never has forgiven himself for inheriting everything, you know. A surge of emotion was struggling against the bands I had placed around my heart. It beat hard. I felt it awaken, stir, and stretch. My hands trembled. I didn't know, I murmured. She laughed lightly. Well, what did you think they were doing? I looked away in embarrassment. I assumed... They were involved in a different sort of behavior. Rachel suddenly gasped. Conquests? You didn't really think. She burst into laughter. Oh, it's no wonder you've been acting so miserable since they left, you poor thing. She put an arm around my shoulder as she laughed, but I was too mortified to join in. After a moment, she pulled away and said gently, But how could you suspect Philip of such behavior, considering how close you two are? I would have thought that you would know his character better than that. Don't you know what sort of gentleman Philip is? I dropped my head into my hands. I don't, I mumbled. I don't know anything. Well, I have known Philip my entire life, and I can tell you what sort of man he is. I looked up. The very best kind, she said, watching me carefully, and he deserves the very best kind of lady for his wife. But I don't think Cecily fits that description. Do you? I looked at her sharply. Guilt for secretly agreeing with Rachel battled with loyalty within me. Loyalty won.
No, you're mistaken. Cecily has some wonderful qualities. She is well-suited for the sort of elegant lifestyle Sir Philip can provide. Rachel smiled kindly. It's obvious what you're doing, and you are very noble to try to step out of the way for your sister. But she's not the one Philip wants. I regarded her in silence, wanting to believe her. But what if she was just meddling, like Lady Caroline? How could I dare allow myself to hope? My will battled with my heart, and I sat stunned, with my heart begging me to hope.
Do you know what I think? Rachel asked.
I shook my head. She held up the letter from William. I think that Philip has been just as miserable as you since he left, which leads me to believe that something has come between you two. I touched my cheek, trying to smooth away my blush. There was nothing to come between us. We have been friends, that is all. She raised both eyebrows. Philip does not look at you the way a man looks at his friend. I looked away, embarrassed and miserable. That's just because he's a flirt. He doesn't mean anything by it.
A flirt? Whatever gave you that idea?
I blinked in surprise. I thought it was common knowledge. Miss Fairhurst led me to believe that everyone knew about his reputation. Rachel looked astonished.
You believe Miss Fairhurst? Really, Marianne, I thought you had more sense than that.
I stared at her.
You mean he's not a flirt?
She looked at me for a long time, as if debating what to say.
I won't deny that many ladies have fallen in love with him, but I will tell you this. I have never seen Philip behave toward anyone the way he behaves toward you.
My thoughts spun as every assumption on which I had built my understanding of Philip dissolved. I looked at my hands in my lap and saw them trembling.
Rachel, I am willing to admit that I have been fooled and confused and very naive. But if Philip did feel something for me, why didn't he say anything?
She leaned toward me, speaking urgently.
Marianne, you must understand that Philip has a very strong sense of what it means to be a gentleman, and according to his principles, he couldn't court you, considering the circumstances.
I was confused.
What do you mean? What circumstances? You have been in a very vulnerable position, with your father far away and without another man to protect you. Philip took on a guardian's role when he took you in as his guest. Indeed, he told your grandmother that he would act as your protector while you stayed here. How could he declare himself while he was in that position of responsibility toward you? Don't you see how his sense of honor as a gentleman would have prevented that unless he was sure of your feelings? He wouldn't take advantage of your vulnerability by declaring himself while you were so obligated to him.
I twisted my hands together while my thoughts reeled. Why had I never considered any of this? Probably for the same reason I had hidden my feelings for Philip from myself. I didn't want to face what could potentially break my heart. And then there was the issue of Cecily's feelings.
Of course, Rachel said. If he was certain of your feelings, he probably would have said something.
I laughed a little. I wasn't even certain of my feelings. And then there was the fact that Cecily had claimed him first. Rachel nodded.
I thought as much. But if Philip had loved Cecily, or had even been interested in her, he would have courted her in London. So I think you can put aside that doubt. The real question is, what are you going to do to encourage Philip to declare himself to you?
My mouth fell open.
Do? What do you mean? I'm not going to do anything. I don't even know how Philip feels about me.
Rachel scoffed.
Philip has been wearing his heart on his sleeve for the whole world to see. He obviously loves you, but everyone needs some encouragement, and I think you need to be prepared to offer some encouragement when Philip returns.
She left me after that, smiling as if she was very pleased with herself. Standing, I paced back and forth in front of the fireplace. My thoughts tumbled furiously. Philip and William were at Newmarket at the horse races, not off carousing. I wondered how I could have misunderstood Rachel when we had first discussed the men's trip. I couldn't remember the exact words we had exchanged, but I had felt certain that I knew what she had been talking about. Words were such slippery things. I could take Rachel's words and understand them in one way, and then look at them again from her perspective and understand them in a completely different way. The same thing had happened when I had listened to her read from William's letter. I'd felt certain he was referring to Philip's falling in love with a woman, not a horse. Was there something flawed about my thinking? Or had one wrong assumption led to another? Words alone were ambiguous, unreliable. But what could be reliable if not words? I was so caught up in trying to understand how I had made my mistaken judgment that I almost overlooked a significant part of my conversation with Rachel. I had been right about Philip's character. Rachel had confirmed what I had initially thought, that Philip was a gentleman and that he would not participate in the sorts of activities I had suspected him of. Perhaps I was right about something else, too. Perhaps I was right when I thought that Philip really did care for me, if only as a friend. Maybe, just maybe, I had misinterpreted what he had told William in the fencing room. Maybe he felt honor-bound not to declare himself while he was responsible for me, and that's why he said he wanted to be rid of his responsibility toward me. I turned from the thought. It was too much to hope for. As far as whether or not he was a flirt, I gave that some thought as well. It occurred to me that I had never seen Philip flirt with anyone besides me. He had certainly never flirted with Cecily or Miss Grace. I had observed him at the ball, and he had not smiled at any other young lady the way he had smiled at me. He had never had that teasing gleam in his eyes when he looked at anyone else. I shook my head in wonder. It was possible. It was just possible that I had been mistaken before. I wanted to believe that I was mistaken now, and not just for my own sake. I desperately wanted to believe that I really knew Philip. I had fallen in love with the man I thought him to be, and I wanted to believe that man existed. My heart and mind battled until I could no longer think and rethink everything. I understood Philip's love letter now, when he wrote about being driven to the edge of madness by love. I was at the edge of madness myself, and I had to do something to distract myself. I walked outside and made my way to the stable. I stepped inside Meg's stall, picked up the currycomb, and began to groom her. I had always enjoyed grooming horses. There was something about the shushing sound of the brush against their coat and the warmth of their flank against my hand that soothed me. The repetitive action and quiet calm allowed me to ponder what Rachel had told me. I had no clear answers about Philip, but I had hope, and I was willing to wait and find out for myself what was true and what was false. A thought rose to the surface of my mind as I brushed Meg. I was not entirely unwanted here. Lady Caroline liked me, I was sure of it. And Rachel seemed to like me too. She went out of her way to talk to me and give me hope about Philip. And Cecily was a devoted sister. She wanted me here too. The joy that realization granted me was overwhelming. Leaning my head against Meg's neck, I sniffed as tears of relief and happiness streamed down my cheeks. Then I laughed at myself, lifted my head, and wiped my cheeks. Surely I had cried enough in the past week to last a lifetime. I was turning into a watering pot, and that was unlike me. "So, you're a racehorse," I said to Meg, as I continued to brush her. "You should have told me. If I had known, I would have pushed you harder. We could have beaten that black horse of his." She whinnied in response. Chapter 23 William and Philip had told their mother that they would return in time for the ball she was hosting, but it was the day before the ball, and neither of them had made an appearance. That afternoon, I sat in the drawing room dutifully working on some embroidery, while Cecily and Louisa played a duet on the pianoforte. From my position near the window, I was the first to notice the carriage pulling up the drive. I tried not to give in to the hope and excitement bounding through me, but I recognized the carriage. It was the same one Betsy and I had ridden in to come here. It was Philip's carriage. He had come home, after all, just in time for the ball, just as he'd promised. My hand shook, causing me to make an uneven stitch. I set aside my embroidery and took a steadying breath. What would I say to Philip? How would I know his feelings for me? And could I dare to offer him some encouragement, as Rachel had suggested? I heard men's voices outside the door. Then the door opened, and William walked in. He looked around the room and said something in greeting, but I hardly heard his words. I was so distracted by wanting to see Philip. Lady Caroline looked up from her writing desk, and Rachel crossed the room to her husband with a smile. Cecily and Louisa stopped playing the pianoforte. I craned my neck, trying to see beyond William. What was taking Philip so long? Then William asked, "Where is Philip?" I stared at him. "Philip," Lady Caroline said, "is he not with you?" William frowned and looked at me, then quickly looked away again. "No, he said he had something else he had to do, but I thought he would have returned by now." We could give him no answers, as none of us knew that they had separated. William shrugged off the mystery, saying, "I dare say he'll be home tomorrow. I think he planned on being back for the ball." That he could dismiss Philip's absence without telling us anything about where he might be or what he might be doing was completely unsatisfactory. William didn't even offer any explanation as to why he looked at me and frowned. I worried that Philip had stayed away because he didn't want to see me again. It was an unbearable thought. I left the drawing room and asked the butler to find Betsy for me and send her to my room. I was pacing back and forth in front of my fireplace when Betsy threw open the door and ran into the room.
"What is it, miss?"
she asked, out of breath. "I need you to find out where Sir Philip is and why he did not return with his brother." Her eyes lit up with a gleam of excitement mixed with determination.
"If there's something to be learned, I will learn it. Never fear, miss."
She flew out of the room. Less than half an hour had passed when the door opened and Betsy ran back into the room. I was accustomed to her dramatic entrances, so it didn't alarm me.
"What have you learned?" I asked. "Nobody knows where Sir Philip has gone, miss."
She pressed a hand to her chest as she panted, trying to catch her breath.
"The coachman said that he left Newmarket 4 days ago. He said that Sir Philip was acting strangely, hardly paying any attention to the Rices. And after 2 days of it, Mr. Wyndham said to him, 'I can't bear any more of your moping. Go win her.' That's when Sir Philip left, not saying anything about where he would go or what he would do."
She stared at me with wide eyes.
"What do you think of it all?"
I shook my head, dumbfounded. "I have no idea. But I did know one thing. If Philip was going to win someone, I wanted it to be me." Later that morning, I left the house with my sketchbook and made my way to the orchard. I was restless with impatience to see Philip, and I could not sit inside with the other ladies another moment. I couldn't bear to listen to Cecily fretting about her plans for Philip to propose at the ball, and how they would be ruined if he did not return in time. I still didn't know what I would say when I saw Philip again, but I had come to a conclusion. I would not run a different race simply because I was afraid of losing to Cecily. If Philip truly was the gentleman I thought him to be, and the one Rachel swore he was, then Cecily did not deserve him. Sitting with my back against the trunk of a tree, I sketched a cluster of apples hanging from a thick branch. Concentrating on my subject, I initially did not notice the sound of footsteps in the grass. But suddenly, a flash of dark coat from the corner of my eye caught my attention.
My heart leapt. It was Philip. He had come home in time for the ball, just as he had promised, and he had found me here in the orchard because he knew me so well. What would I say to him? What would he say to me? I set aside my drawing and stood up, smoothing my skirt, then my hair. I didn't need to pinch my cheeks, because my face was already warm with the nervousness that flooded me. He had to be nearby. I heard more rustling, and then I saw him emerge from the trees. I turned to him with a hesitant smile. My smile immediately faltered. "Mr. Beaufort," I said, disappointment coloring my voice. He bowed. "Miss Daventry, you look so beautiful here, among the blossoms." "What are you doing here?" I didn't mean to sound rude, but I had no patience for polite conversation right now. He walked toward me, smiling, and said, "I have come to change your mind." He grabbed me around the waist, pulled me to him, and pressed his mouth against mine. I pulled my head back and pushed against his chest. "Unhand me at once!" I was no match for his strength, though. He only pulled me more tightly against him. "Listen to me carefully," he whispered, his mouth too close to my face. "We are madly in love, and we are going to run off together. By the time we're discovered, your grandmother, or father, or whoever it is who cares about you, will be happy to have me marry you. And then we will live very happily together on your fortune." I froze. He knew about my inheritance? "Fortune?" I laughed. "There is no fortune." His eyes glinted. "You think to make a fool of me. I know very well there is a fortune of £40,000 waiting for you to inherit. My good uncle, Mr. Whittles, overheard your grandmother say as much while he was in her house." I remembered the day my grandmother had told me about the inheritance, and how I had found Mr. Whittles outside the door. I shook my head. "It has not been made official. My grandmother will leave me nothing if you ruin my reputation." He smiled. "I think she will, but there is no need to ruin your reputation. Just accept my offer. Think of the enticements, my dear. I will shower you with gifts, give you everything you want, even your freedom, as long as you allow me my freedom in return." "You'll give me everything I want with my own money?" I laughed at him. "You're absurd." His hand grabbed my waist so tightly it hurt. "Do not speak to me like that." I suddenly recognized that this was no game, and that I was literally in the grip of an unscrupulous man. "You do not need to do this," I said, fear pounding with every beat of my heart. "My grandmother will give you money, like a ransom. You don't need to take me anywhere." I smiled at him, but his eyes stayed hard. "Whatever amount she offers, it cannot be more than your inheritance, and so I will have to reject that idea. Now, we are going to hold hands and run off to the carriage I have waiting down the road. If anyone sees us, they will believe we are two young people desperately in love." I shook my head. "You're mad. I won't go with you." He reached into his coat pocket and pulled out something gold, which he let slip through his fingers so that it dangled from a chain. I gasped. "My locket!" My thoughts went reeling as I tried to make sense of what was before me. "You were the highwayman? The one who shot my coachman?" He smiled, and cold chills ran down my spine. "What did you do to James? Why did he leave the inn?"
"Don't worry about him. Once I learned from him exactly where you were going, I convinced him to leave the area and seek other employment. He was sensible."
The terror of that night, of the masked highwayman, the pistol, and James bleeding in the road rushed back to me. My knees trembled and my voice shook. "What did you want from me that night?"
"I wanted the same thing I have always wanted, a fortune. I admit that my first attempt was a little unpolished. I thought only to run away with you by any means necessary. But when your maid shot at me, I abandoned that endeavor. I was certainly not going to risk my neck when there were other ways to get what I wanted. I had hoped to convince you to marry me based on my own merits, but you were unable to appreciate what I had to offer. And so it has come to this.
He put the locket back into his pocket and then pulled something else out.
You remember this, do you not?
It was a pistol. I nodded my head very carefully. He smiled.
Good.
He slipped the gun back into his pocket.
Now, let's be off, my love.
He grabbed my hand and started to run through the orchard. I tried to pull my hand out of his grip and opened my mouth to scream. He stopped abruptly, clamped his hand over my mouth and whispered,
"It will be much simpler if you go along with the plan. You see, I have somebody waiting for you in the carriage, and I believe she is the one who shot at me last time. You do not want her to be hurt the way your coachman was hurt, do you?"
He had Betsy. More than my own life depended on my actions right now. I carefully shook my head. He smiled.
"I knew you would be able to see reason."
He pulled on my hand again, and this time I did not resist. Just beyond the orchard was a short path that cut through the woods. After several minutes, we emerged onto the road where a closed carriage stood, with the horses tied to a tree. Mr. Beaufort opened the carriage door and bowed.
"I hope you have a comfortable journey."
I saw immediately that the carriage was empty.
"You lied to me!"
I tried to pull away from him, but he grabbed me around the waist and threw me into the carriage. He leaned in and said,
"I would not try to jump out if I were you. People have been known to have their brains dashed on the rocks when they try it."
"Wait!" I lunged for the door, which he was already closing. "Where are you taking me?" I shouted. He smiled at me through the window. I was beginning to suspect that he was mad.
"To Dover, my love."
I felt the carriage sway as he climbed up to the coachman's box. He was going to drive, which meant there was not even a coachman who might come to my rescue. I flung myself at the door and yanked on the handle. It was broken. I tried the other door, but it did not have a handle at all. I screamed in frustration and beat at the door. Mr. Beaufort had only been tricking me with that comment, giving me the hope of escape if I had but the courage to take the leap. I thought I heard him laugh, and then the carriage swayed, and I was being driven away swiftly, with no one to hear my screams. Chapter 24. It did not take me long to understand what would happen to me if I did not escape. To be ruined by reputation was just as damaging as to be ruined in actuality. No one would want me if I passed the night with Mr. Beaufort, no matter what he did or did not do to me. Fear ballooned in my chest at the thought. I tried to break the window, beating at it with my fists, but the glass held. After a while, I dropped to the bench, exhausted. I could no longer hope for rescue from anyone, nor escape. I tried not to cry while my hopes raced away from me. I kept watch out the window in an attempt to make sense of where we were going, but since I was not familiar with the area, the road we traveled on meant nothing to me. It felt as if we rode for hours. I was sick twice and left all of my breakfast on the floor of the carriage. And then, utterly wretched, I lay on the bench and tried not to breathe through my nose. The sky was grey and colourless when the carriage finally stopped. It felt like we had been travelling all day long. When Mr. Beaufort opened the carriage door, he reared back, holding his hand over his mouth and nose. It gave me a tiny bit of satisfaction. I sat up and stepped over my breakfast, holding my gown out of the way. He grabbed my elbow and helped me down. I was too weak and ill to try to run from him, and besides that, I didn't know where I would run. The fresh, salty air I breathed in was a welcome relief, though.
"What happened in there?"
he asked.
I get sick in carriages." He looked disgusted, then a frown creased his brow.
"What about boats?"
"I've never ridden in one, but I assume I would get sick on a boat as well." I almost smiled at his expression. He muttered something under his breath, then pulled me toward an inn.
"We're going to eat supper here. I don't want to have anyone else involved, and I am sure you do not either. If you will recall, I have no compunction about shooting someone who gets in my way."
I understood him perfectly. Anyone who might be in a position to help me in the inn would be risking his life to do so, just like James. I looked up at the inn and the wood sign bearing the words, "The Rose and Crown." I felt a strange sense of having been in this moment before. The last inn I had stopped at, the night James was shot, had also been called the Rose and Crown. To be sure, it was a common name for inns, but it still seemed strangely significant. Inside the inn, Mr. Beaufort asked for a private parlour and supper. A few people sat in the tap room, but Mr. Beaufort's tight grip on my arm reminded me of his threat, and I held my tongue. Besides that, I felt too weak and nauseated to fight him. The small parlour we were led to offered a startling contrast to how I felt. A bright fire crackled, a table was well lit, and the furniture was clean and nice. Mr. Beaufort gestured toward a chair.
"Please, make yourself comfortable."
I wished he wouldn't pretend to be a gentleman. It made his course of action all the more appalling. I considered refusing to do what he wanted, but I quickly dismissed that idea. It would be best for me to placate him as much as possible, so I sat at the table and watched him carefully. He took the chair closest to the door, leaning back with his legs crossed. "You can't possibly imagine you'll get away with this," I said. "My father will never agree to this marriage." He opened his snuff box and took a pinch. When he was done, he looked at me languidly and said in a bored voice, "Your father cares so little about what happens to you that he abandoned you to the care of a feeble old woman who can't even take care of herself. You have no other male family members, no one to protect you, no one to fight for you." His lip curled. "You, my dear, are the ideal victim. And since we are going to France, I think it will be a long time before your father finds you."
"France?" I said in surprise.
"Yes, France. We sail as soon as the tide turns."
He smiled coldly.
"You understand, of course, that I couldn't let anyone find us until you were safely mine."
Did he know my father was in France? I doubted it, considering the fact that he thought going there would put us out of my father's reach. I laughed, hard and short.
"I will never be yours."
His gaze swept over me.
"You will, and probably sooner than you think."
A shiver of revulsion rolled down my spine, and fear quickened my pulse, but I lifted my chin. "I am a lady, sir. I may agree to marry you, if forced, but you will not be permitted to touch me." My voice only shook a little. He smiled.
"And what will you do if I try? Fight me?"
"Yes." I met his gaze boldly. He laughed softly, and even I could see how humorous my claim was. I was half his size, and surely had less than half his strength. Besides that, he had a weapon in his possession. Well, then my superiority would simply have to come from my wits. The innkeeper brought in a tray of food and a decanter of wine, which she sat on the table. Mr. Beaufort piled food on his plate and poured himself a large glass of wine.
"Please, eat if you'd like."
I couldn't eat. It was impossible. The sight of the food was enough to make me gag. And yet, I wanted to allay suspicion and make him believe I would be submissive. I chose the least revolting dish and methodically spooned it into my mouth and swallowed while watching Mr. Beaufort carefully. He paid no attention to me, just ate and drank his wine as if he were dining alone.
That was good. It gave me an opportunity to look around the room. I didn't see much in the way of weapons. Along with the table and chairs and fireplace, there was a low bench by the window and a writing desk in one corner. I couldn't see anything heavy enough to hit him with except the chairs, and those were too large for me to wield. The prospects were discouraging. Even the knife I was given to eat with would not be of any use, dull and blunted as it was. I had to be more creative. I looked again at the furniture in the room, and my eyes rested on the writing desk. I saw a quill, an inkstand, and a small stack of paper. I hoped somewhere on that desk would be a penknife for sharpening the quill. A plan formed in my mind. I considered my other choices, quickly realizing I had no other choices, really, other than trying to run out the door, or letting Mr. Beaufort do what he wanted to with me. The thought made me so nervous that my hand shook and I had to set my fork down. I suddenly recalled my first evening at Edenbrook when I had walked into the dining room on Philip's arm. What had he said to me?
Try taking a deep breath. It might help you relax.
The memory lightened my heart a little. I took a deep breath, steadying my nerves, and watched Mr. Beaufort. He was drinking, but not eating much. He poured himself three glasses, and at the end of the third glass, he set it down clumsily on the table. This was probably the best time for me to make my attempt. I smiled shyly at him. I didn't realize how hungry I was. It's hard to think clearly when you're hungry, don't you agree? He raised an eyebrow.
I'd never considered it.
Well, that's how it always is with me. I lowered my eyes meekly. I couldn't think earlier about what a pleasure it might be to be married to such a man as you. I glanced up through my eyelashes and saw a look of gratification pass over his features.
You're coming to your senses, are you?
He laughed.
It never takes them long.
Oh, I can believe it. Why, just watching you here, in the candlelight. I let my voice trail off. His eyes lit up with interest.
Go on.
I was just admiring the way the light brings out your handsome features. Your strong jaw, the way your eyes... I looked down and willed myself to blush. I felt my face grow warm. At least I could always count on that skill.
Don't stop now.
I'm too shy, I said quietly.
You don't need to be shy, he coaxed. Soon there will be nothing to be shy about. We'll know everything about each other.
I inwardly cringed, but kept my face lowered so he couldn't see my expression. Perhaps I could write it down instead, like a love letter. He sat back in his chair.
Well, this is certainly a novel experience.
He contemplated me for a moment, and I waited tensely.
Why not? The night is still young.
He gestured toward the writing desk. Mr. Beaufort poured himself another glass of wine while I walked to the desk. My legs felt unsteady with nervousness. I carefully sat down and angled my body to hide what I was doing from him. I searched the writing desk, and I was not disappointed. The penknife rested next to the quill. It had a small blade, no longer than my fingernail, but it was wickedly sharp. It would have to do. I took a piece of paper from the stack and dipped the quill in ink. I wrote quickly. Dear Philip, I don't imagine you will ever read this. If you do, it is because something dreadful has happened to me. I find myself in the hands of a dangerous man. I am determined to fight him, but before I do, my heart demands that I write this note to tell you that I love you. I am sending my heart to you in this letter, so it will be kept safe from whatever may happen to me tonight. I don't know if you want it or not, but it has always been yours. With all my love, Marianne. A tear or two dropped onto the paper, blurring some of my words. Mr. Beaufort cleared his throat. I hurriedly folded the paper into a small square, writing Sir Philip Wyndham, Edenbrook, Kent, on the outside. I wondered where I could hide the letter. My bodice? No, that might be the first place Mr. Beaufort would find it. My stomach lurched at the thought, and I was afraid I would be sick again.